This is a recording of the public hearing on Website and Internet Communications Improvement Initiative held by the Federal Election Commission on July 29, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Now we convene the open session that we began this morning on how to improve our website, and I want to just thank you all for being here. We have Mr. Clay Johnson from the Sunlight Foundation, who I understand is director of Sunlight Labs, Lisa Rosenberg, who we've worked with from the outside from Sunlight, Michael Malbin, executive director of the Campaign Finance Institute, and Daryl West from the Brookings Institute, vice president and director of governance studies. We look very much forward to your comments. As we mentioned, we'll ask each of you to give some preliminary comments at the length that you desire, and then we'll start with the informal questions and answers. So, Mr. Johnson, if you'd begin. Thanks again.
And certainly.
Welcome back.
Thank you very much again for giving me your time to hear my testimony. I think all of us at the Sunlight Foundation really appreciate the opportunity and are excited that you all are beginning the process of opening up on the web. The Sunlight Foundation was founded in 2006 to help use the internet to create a more accountable and responsible government. The organization inside of Sunlight that I head is called Sunlight Labs, and what we are is a community of developers. There's over 1,000 of us now that work to take data that comes out of government and do interesting things with it. We've gotten the sense from the FEC through talking with lots of people at the FEC that you guys are, in fact, deeply committed to revamping this web operation, and we think that's really exciting. Before coming to Sunlight, I was one of the four founders of a company called Blue State Digital. We did Barack Obama's website in 2008. We powered the website of the Democratic National Committee. And I've helped a lot of party committees, nonprofits, and other organizations make the transition to strong professional web presences. And I thought it was important for me to come in and give you all some advice on how to do this right. We did submit some testimony. What I'm going to say here today, I think, will probably be a little bit more tactical than what is in our testimony, our written testimony. See, I'm here not with just a list of what you should do, but actually there's an order that you should do this stuff in that's actually quite important. The first thing that you need is a structural change in the leadership of the organization. And no, I'm not talking about you guys. But what I am talking about is the hiring of what you would call
it. Leave that to others.
Right. What I am talking about is the hiring of a new media director. The other executive agencies have created the position of new media director inside, including the White House, the EPA, and other agencies. And I think that needs to happen here as well. There needs to be someone here that's operationally in charge of this process. That's probably not all six of you. So your website just isn't a project inside of the organization. The website isn't a slice of the pie. It's the pan. It is going to be the thing that will augment and strengthen everything that this agency does. And the first thing that you need is day-to-day leadership in this effort. Your new media director should not be a part of your IT department, nor should it be a part of your communications department. And this is something that's really hard for organizations to figure out. If it's a part of your IT department, then you end up with a lot of technology for the sake of technology. You end up with a power struggle between information technology and communications. And if it's part of your communications organization, then it ends up you end up with a website that's full of press releases, but no real engagement with people, and no one really looking out for the end users of your organization. The position personally requires a level of technical skill that communications directors often don't have, and a level of communication skills that very few of us technical folks, myself very much included, don't have. Let's see. So step one is hire a new media director that can manage all media communications, manage the agency's agenda and message online, measure and track performance of the agency's websites, and work closely with the technology team to build and maintain the FEC's web practices. The new media director should be a customer of your IT shop. They will coordinate and develop the content, manage the web, email, and various social platform outreach efforts of the FEC, and develop an overall strategy for your online program and liaison with the other functional areas of your agency to integrate online programming. Have them report. I'm not sure how that the FEC is structured internally besides the organization chart that's posted online, but my recommendation is that you have them report to the staff director in the same way that your CIO or your communications director does. And I've actually brought job descriptions with me of new media directors that the other executive agencies are using. If you'd like to have a copy, I'm happy to submit that. I don't know what the process is.
Thanks very much. We'd like that.
The second step is to get your house in order in terms of data. And I think you'll hear me echoing what the previous panel was about to a certain extent. If you can't do this, then everything else sort of doesn't matter. If you can't make sure that the data that the FEC has is clean, sanitary, and accurate, then building tools on top of it is generally useless. Because you're then just taking the same dirty data and showing it to people that could not be accurate. So it seems to me like the top priority is not visualizations. It's not making your user interface or navigation fixing those problems, but is instead focusing on acquiring data from your suppliers, campaigns, and committees, and delivering it to people in the best way possible. See, the FEC is trying to be, I think, a retailer and a wholesaler at the same time. And there's only one organization on the planet that you have a monopoly on federal campaign expenditure and contribution data. So while organizations like the New York Times and the Huffington Post and Open Secrets and Sunlight Labs and a plethora of other organizations are in fact retailers of this data, they create maps, they create visualizations, and they get more web traffic than the FEC and Sunlight will ever hope to get. The FEC is the single source supplier of this data, and we believe at the Sunlight Foundation that it should be your primary focus to make this data as complete, as clean, as accurate as humanly possible. That first includes changing the way that campaigns and committees file with you to make that an open, standardized process. And this is where I think a lot of you are going to go, uh-oh, Clay's going to slip into a technology mode, and with the exception of one of the commissioners, I know that you're not all programmers. But you should, I think, work to over the next 4 years create what's called an open standard of, I think, one of the last panelists said XML, but it can be any open standard format that isn't a proprietary or customized format that the FEC puts out to both receive and deliver data. So let me explain to you a little bit about what's important here. So right now, the FEC has about a dozen formats that it publishes data in and .fec files. And these aren't just CSVs. They are a proprietary. They're not proprietary, but they're a custom format that only the FEC uses. So when I, as a developer, want to go use a tool to open up this information, actually can't go use a tool. I have to write my own. I have to go and say I'm going to go and write a Python or a Ruby script or some form of programming language to parse this information and make sense of it to put it into a database. And if you went to an open standard, say XML, I could then go and get an XML library that then made it very a lot easier for me to then take the data and manipulate it. There's sort of a built-in shortcut for me that makes that barrier achievable. But learning the different formats, even at the Sunlight Foundation, we've struggled with keeping up with and learning all the different formats that you all are putting out. I would aim to have a standard format by 2010 that you've adopted, and aim to phase out the collection of data through your proprietary formats through 2012. I think, you know, there's a lot of discussion in the last panel about FecFile. I think it's a great tool that's freely available for people to have, but you should work to change it to work with an open standard so that other people can also make tools that maybe even compete with FecFile and could be better. The focus should be to, again, take the FEC out of the retail process and into the wholesale process of making it so that developers are supported, citizens are supported, and campaigns are supported with a cohesive technical architecture. Once you have your house in order in terms of data, and data is coming into the system in a reliable standard and extensible format, then you can start building tools on top of the data. But until then, I don't think it's a valuable use of time. While your IT team is working on that, hopefully your new media director can engage in a redesign process for the FEC website. Now, at Sunlight, we actually took the liberty of redesigning your website, and we just thought it would be an interesting design exercise. I brought copies of that with me as well, with some suggestions as to how it could look. And since a picture is worth 1,000 words, I don't have enough time in this testimony to sort of explain everything here. But there is on the sunlightlabs.com blog a long explanation of the changes that we made, and I know that a lot of people from the FEC looked at it, and I'm happy to give those to you while we're here today. The next thing that you're going to need after your design process is complete is then to start thinking about what's called a content management system. What a content management system does is it makes it so that you can post stuff on the internet. It makes it, you know, so that instead of having to go to a developer to post stuff on the internet, you can, you know, edit a web form and click a submit button, and, you know, the article that you wrote goes on website. There's a big tendency amongst federal agencies to buy what are called enterprise content management systems. We found at Blue State Digital the most amount of money that we've spent on a content management system license was about $100 for a content management system called Expression Engine. That's what powered a lot of the BarackObama.com stuff. The other content management system that BarackObama.com used is a content management system called Movable Type. I realize that those things are, you know, I realize that probably none of you are going to be actually, you know, strongly involved or have strong opinions on which content management system to choose, but I just want to point out that there are some lightweight options out there that are very cheap and can save the taxpayers and the FEC a lot of money. The content management system will lay the foundation at the outset for your online strategy, but what's important here is that your new media director drive that decision rather than your IT shop, as it is she or he that will be the primary user of the system. So too should it be that your new media director lead your design process. Also, at that time, the new media director should be looking at language issues on your website so that you can start saying things like 24-hour notice of disbursement / obligations for electioneering purposes into something that non-campaign workers and non-legal professionals can understand. The final thing I want to add here is that we did something interesting. We actually, when we heard of this testimony, we launched our own open brainstorming process and solicited ideas for the FEC that then I promised our community I would come in here and report to you of how this works. So we set up basically a simple web page, and we said, submit your ideas, and then we allowed people to vote on all the different ideas. Now, this is the FEC is sort of an arcane thing. It's hard to sort of engage the masses on, you know, FEC website, you know, and regulations, but we did this. And we found that While we weren't audited, by some giant corporation, we did find that the ideas that people came up with aligned very much with our own testimony, and much of these ideas informed the testimony that I'm giving here. The first one was replace FEC file, which I spoke about earlier, with an open standard, and then make FEC file adhere to that open standard. The second most votes was hire a new media director. The third was make RSS feeds available for new content. What that means is allow people to subscribe to get updates when a particular committee files, or when new contributions have come in. Provide a REST. I know this is a stretch. It's REST. That's a type of technical architecture API. And you've heard that, I think, twice today. That's a way for you to share data with other websites to the candidate summary information to allow for the creation of widgets. Now, what widgets are things that people can embed, on their web pages, like a photo album or something like that. On summary information, so imagine someone can they put in a YouTube video, they could put in something from the FEC that says this is how much money that this particular candidate raised this quarter, and just easily embed that information. Sixth was allow. This is an interesting idea. Allow for campaigns to opt in to real-time disclosure with the FEC. So if a candidate wanted to send you contribution information as they received them, and they wanted to opt into that without any form of embargo, allow them to do that. We saw that, I think, in 2004 with Ron Paul, who he didn't do it with the FEC, but he did put his contributions online for everyone to see during his campaign process. And then seven, actually with the least amount of votes, but it is perhaps a fairly specific change, although it only got three votes. I think it's more of a bug report than it is an idea, is ensure that the total contribution amounts on summary pages equals the total sum amount of the individual contributions, which apparently it does not. I haven't checked that out. Again, this has all been submitted by community, voted on by community, and again, they all seem in line with the recommendations we're making. But again, all this stuff relies on finding a new media director for your organization who can drive this process from the start. Ideally, we want to get you to a point where you can have your own brainstorms with people and take this feedback in, and they become natural for the FEC to have a dialogue with its end users. The software, by the way, that we used to build this online brainstorm application is all open source free software and was up and running in a matter of hours. Note here that this is a public online solicitation process, and no ideas were submitted asking for additional visualizations of campaign finance information or expenditures. I think this comes down to a single reason. While anybody, the New York Times, the Huffington Post, Open Secrets, Sunlight Labs, can make maps and visualizations of the data that you produce, only the FEC can produce the data that powers these maps. Thus, I think the consensus from our community is for the FEC to really think about how it can improve being a wholesale provider of the data that it publishes online, as well as a retail provider through the website. But I think wholesale comes first. Again, I want to thank you for your time and commitment to improving the FEC's new media operation. I'm really excited to see you all again, and hope that you're as excited as I am about the kinds of changes that you can make. And I just want to say again, Sunlight is here to help in any way that we can. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thanks for all the initiative you've taken to help us out. That's very interesting and very enterprising, and we really appreciate that. We have Mr. Melvin, Professor Melvin.
Thank you for undertaking this initiative. For the record, the Campaign Finance Institute is a strictly nonpartisan 10-year-old organization affiliated with George Washington University, and I'm right between these two microphones. I'm also a professor of political science at State University of New York, Albany, as well as CFI's executive director. Transparency policy and implementation have been high priorities for CFI from the beginning. Our first Blue Ribbon Task Force was on disclosure, and we've issued numerous reports on the subject since then. I address your specific questions, the ones that are in the Federal Register, in my written comments and my oral comments today. I'm going to focus on the fundamental issues. As I see it, the FEC has two principal functions. One is to administer laws that regulate the behavior of those who raise or spend money in connection with federal elections. The second is to serve as the government's prime vehicle for campaign finance disclosure. Form should follow function. The FEC's website should serve these two central purposes, and I would argue they should do, it should do so equally. One being to explain and implement the law, and the other being to disclose campaign finance activity. As you heard this morning, the website is better now than 10 years ago, and I'll talk a little bit about that, and especially better for lawyers and other prime users. But I want to focus on the second of the two purposes, disclosure. Before you launch a website redesign, and I agree that you need also some of the basic data issues that were talked about, I urge you to step back and ask, what is the purpose of disclosure? For this function, the key purpose is not fundamentally about helping lawyers or candidates or political committees. The key purpose, as expressed in Buckley against Valeo, is to bring campaign finance information to the public so information, so individuals may decide whether to use that information when they vote. So for disclosure to serve that purpose, the public needs useful information in an intelligible format and in a timely way. So to accomplish those needs, I think those purposes, the public's needs, must be at the forefront of all portions of website redesign that are aimed at disclosure. It's an unfortunate matter of fact that until the FEC put its interactive map on the homepage during the 2008 election cycle, it did almost nothing at all to educate or speak to the general public directly. To reach the public, the FEC seemed in the past to rely almost entirely on the media and on nonprofit intermediary organizations such as CFI and a lot of others you know about. The Internet makes a more direct route possible, and I urge you to grasp the opportunity. With the current economics of journalism, it is foolhardy to rely on reporters to cover politics well, and it's equally important, in my opinion, not to rely on the nonprofit sector. And this is going to be a difference in emphasis between what I'm saying and what was just said. I would guess that the total number of people working on campaign finance in the nonprofit sector who understand the data or know this stuff is probably, in the entire country, is smaller than the number of people who work at the FEC. We put out some of the information we do because you don't. If you did the job, we'd be happy to step back because there's a lot more for us to do by focusing on analysis and value-added material. So, no, let me add a point that I didn't make in the written statement, and it does go to the point that was just made. The nonprofit sector, as well as research scholars, are crucial. I don't mean to be downplaying them. We never want to find ourselves in a position where the only sources of information are filtered through government prisms. Since any structured database query is a prism, the public's ability to exercise its right to know in a meaningful way will depend in part on your making raw data and good raw data available in a timely and transparent way to others like us who will mash up the data with other material to produce other value-added information. So that's still a crucial part of the picture. But even though these kind of research organizations are crucial, I reiterate the previous point that the general public should not have to rely on us for their basic information. I just disagree with the comments on the first panel. I think this is a point on the first panel. I think that informing the public directly and clearly is a core function of the commission, and that you ought to accept that as a public obligation and not put the first impression into other people's hands. I think you need to do both. That is to say, I think you need to do both retail and wholesale. If you do agree, and if you define the task as bringing campaign finance information to the public as a core function, this will simplify the process of setting priorities. The rock bottom function is to serve voters. It is not, for example, to provide interactive blogs on policy, although blogs on the website or blogs on the disclosure function, as I will argue later, can be very useful. But anything that draws away from the central information function should be resisted, at least until all of the steps useful for that function are taken care of. The core function in the disclosure realm tells you to put the voters first. That is, to get the candidates' information record and the records up quickly in a usable form, and I want to emphasize the word usable. I do agree that that doesn't necessarily mean graphic, although the programs around now just interpret the quantitative information and put up a pie chart in no time at all. That's an easy step. So I'm delighted to see this initiative. I'm going to give a little more personal historical background as a scene setter for the next piece of comment here. 7 years ago, in October 2002, the Task Force on Disclosure issued a report called Website Woes, and I believe only one of you were on the commission at that time, so permit me to do this. The report was critical not just of the FEC's website, but of the lack of interface among government websites. In the weeks after publication, we briefed the FEC staff and many of the commissioners about the findings. Recently, because of this initiative, made me go to the website feeling the kind of disgruntled feeling that a lot of people feel with a lot of websites, I decided to go back and do it this time with the recommendations in hand. And that was a good exercise to go through because it reminded me that you have made a lot of progress. The fact is that most of our recommendations were implemented, a lot of other things are done. It's a lot better. You're not where you need to be, but it's better than it was. The most important improvement is in the overall sense of organization, etc. So for the public, the map on the homepage is intuitive. Once you click on a candidate, it gets you to a useful summary page. The summary page has hot links to contributions that are alphabetical by donor, and that is an advance. Under the old system, a heavy user, such as my organization, could download the whole database and do its own sorting. Fine. If you were a journalist or private citizen who couldn't handle downloads, you were stuck with the PDF files, or else you had to go to an outside website. I think that information should be available through the FEC. So the map is a step forward. But when I went through the exercise, I was reminded of something else. Some months after the briefings and in between these two events, we were invited in, and a staff person showed us a prototype of a system that would let the users sort records on all fields, which, by the way, I think you ought to be able to do. I mean, I agree with the notion that public disclosure in this day and age ought to mean public in a fully searchable and sortable database. 4 years later, you put up the map, and the map lets you sort on a couple of fields, not all. That's an improvement. It didn't reach the prototype. Here are the lessons I drew from that. I was actually really pleased when I was reminded that you didn't do everything that you said you were going to try to do. Because it said that you're no longer going to be the big old style of computer programming organization that was going to wait until it's perfect before you release something. It said that you're willing to put out something that's incrementally better. So let me suggest that's a good thing. That's a good change in attitude. Let me suggest the next step that I think. I'd recommend that you go with some other new practices, and these are ones that you'll see in whitehouse.gov, that let you release what's the equivalent of a beta version of a product, and then have a place on your site to invite comments. You already know how lawyers think about this, or you have a way to find out the way lawyers will think about the website. You have a way to find out the way people like me think about the website. How are you going to find out what people in the public think? Surely not through the Federal Register. So the better way is to roll out modules and seek comments, and to have the equivalent of a blog or at least a comment place. You need to bring the public in on the effort, and not just in a formal comment period beforehand, but in an ongoing way after the launch. Second lesson others have talked about, so I'll just be fast about this. It's going to take you longer than you think now, so you need to set priorities. I urge you, in response to a question asked earlier about setting priorities, to look to take this whole mass of what you're doing and divide it into two piles: the regulated community pile, or the candidate political committee pile, and the disclosure public pile, and to say that whatever the priorities within those, 50% of your efforts are going to go toward the public. As I mentioned, I'm going to defer my written answers to written questions to the question period. In the written testimony, I also put forward a view of a common government-wide election database. I don't need to describe it here, but the point is that raising it was meant to tell you to focus the idea, to focus the goal on the voter as end user, and not on all of us intermediaries. I'm going to wait for questions now, but I do want to make one comment or respond to one point from an earlier panel. One of the people on that panel talked about APIs, and Clay just talked about APIs. And I had the feeling that not everybody was getting it or was. So I just want to.
Probably correct.
I just want to reiterate the point. The simple point, by using an example, is that if you put something up on your website, for example, the candidate summary pages, or any query that is on your website, there's an underlying program that lets you ask the question that is producing the result. You can make that underlying query program available to somebody else. It's easy, it's cheap, it doesn't take great programming to do it, and it means that the newspaper in your hometown can easily, just with a link, without having to do any work, can be getting the material from your web page, and it's your material, and it's automatically available to anybody, to the local weekly. And that's one of the many ways in which you can use it. Again, APIs are definitely something you ought to be looking at. You've heard words thrown at you like API, RSS. The letters are intimidating, but for people who do the computer work, the implementation is easy, and you ought to be looking at them.
Thank you very much. Mr. West.
Thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about the FEC website. For 10 years, I've been studying federal government websites, first at Brown University, where we issued an annual report, and then most recently at the Brookings Institution when I moved here last year. The good news is, when you look over the course of the last decade, there's been tremendous progress on federal government websites. There's a lot more material there, more services, more functionality. They're easier to navigate. But despite that progress, and obviously you realize this, otherwise you wouldn't be holding this hearing, there's still considerable work to do. Each year in our annual studies, we rate the 61 federal agencies, ranging from cabinet departments to independent agencies. In our last study, the Federal Election Commission site rated 48th out of 61 federal sites. The FEC had a total score of 40 out of the total possible 100 points, and the scoring is based on the number of features on the particular site, as well as the number of online services. When you look at the FEC website, it has a number of very valuable features. Publications, which are of great use to lawyers, citizens, journalists, and otherwise. Databases, as Clay pointed out, that's your bread and butter. That's where you have your unique added value. There are audio clips. I was pleased this morning. I was not able to make the earlier panels, but I went to your website and listen to the live audio cast. So that was a great feature. There are privacy policies, electronic updates, various online services, those are all good and valuable features. There are other features that we think are very valuable that we did not find on the website. No video clips, no language translation, no comments for the public to weigh in, no personalization, no PDA accessibility, and no accessibility for the visually impaired. So based on that, we have 8 specific recommendations, and then I will close with 3 more general comments about the website. The specific recommendations are, first of all, to improve the interactive capacity for public feedback through a comments form. I mean, the whole virtue of the internet is two-way communications. And what a lot of federal agencies are starting to do is discover that they need valuable public feedback, and it is a way to really help them. A public comments form is not just an altruistic gesture on your part. It is a way to really get information. Because when you're sitting on top of an organization, you don't really know what it's like in the depths and the experiences that users are having, and you know, various problems that someone might have in accessing information. A comments form is a simple way to get feedback that can be very helpful. As Michael pointed out, the second recommendation is adding personalization. You have multiple audiences at the Federal Election Commission. You've heard from lawyers this morning. There are voters, candidates, journalists, researchers, and students who draw on your information. Personalization is a way to allow people to customize the website to their particular interests. What a lot of state governments are doing, and now federal agencies are starting to do this, is basically people can register under particular categories and say, look, I'm a student. I'm doing a term paper on campaigns, and I need information. Or I'm a journalist, so public disclosure is very important. Or I'm a real candidate or a potential candidate, so I need to know about filing requirements. You can basically allow people to put themselves into one of those categories, and then the website will configure to pull up the information of special importance to that particular audience. So it's a way to add to the functionality of the website. Now, I noted on the website that you do have audio casts of the commission hearings, but there's no video equivalent. There's no webcasting. I think that would be a great feature. There are people in the D.C. area who follow the Federal Election Commission with great interest, but if you're not physically here, you don't get that information. Now, the audio broadcasts are helpful, but it doesn't convey the same level of information that a video webcast would have, so we would recommend adding that. Adding public outreach features through blogs, both Clay and Michael have pointed to some of the virtues in this area. It's a great way to engage the community in a deeper sort of conversation than would be possible through a public comments form. Clay mentioned the RSS feeds. We strongly support that. And for those of you who are not very familiar with them, what an RSS feed does is allow any user to basically come to the site. Let's say that you are especially interested in Senator Charles Schumer. And so you can basically register Senator Schumer. And what that means is anytime information comes to that site relating to him, in the sense that it's his filing or an opponent's filing or, you know, any declaration involving him, that user automatically gets the information sent to them. And they're basically told the FEC has new information related to this particular candidate. Users love this because it really transforms the relationship between people and government. You know, the old-fashioned way was you wait until, if you're a government agency, you wait for the people to come to you, they ask a question, you answer the question. In the new digital world, it is possible for government agencies to become much more proactive, that you can basically put out information. Now, you're not spamming people. People have registered that they are interested in receiving this information, and so it's a great way to basically give them information on the specific topic they want at the time that they want it. So I would say, if I were recommending any one thing, that's a relatively low-cost enhancement that I think would really add a lot of value. Non-English access. We have a large Spanish population here, so some of the documents, particularly as it relates to running for office and campaign finance features associated with that, I think would be of great value there. Improving access for the visually impaired. Here the issue is there's basically a federal requirement on disability access. Courts have basically ruled that in the same way that physical government structures need to be accessible to all Americans, that digital websites basically have to do the same thing. Now, where this issue comes up in regard to websites is there's actually software available for a visually impaired person that will essentially take the contents of that website, the text or other sorts of information, and convert it to an audio file and will read it to the person. So they obviously can't see the website, but their software will essentially provide the audio translation of the content of that site. What it means from the standpoint of website development is you have to have tags on images so that the software works properly. In regard to data and tables, they have to be configured in such a way that this software is able to access particular types of information. There's actually a great a research center at Utah State University, the Center for Persons with Disabilities, that has done a lot of work in this area. So I would recommend that you work with them or consult with their experts on how to do that. And then the last recommendation is mobile access through either smartphones or PDAs. This is really a growth industry in terms of the consumer market. The iPhone and various other smartphones. Increasingly, people are starting to bypass the desktop revolution and accessing digital information through their cell phones. So the FEC should be aware of this and understand that is a future or should be a future goal. Let me close with three quick comments that are a little more general in terms of government websites. First is a comment on the overall web architecture. There's been research that suggests that only 4% of visitors actually enter government websites through the front page. Like, we all envision that somebody who's interested in campaign finance data is actually going to go to the internet and enter FEC.gov, go to the front page, and then kind of search for information there. Research suggests that's actually not how people access information through the internet. What they do is they go to Google or Yahoo or Microsoft, and they type in a term like Nancy Pelosi campaign finance report 2008. And then that will then take them, if the site is properly configured, to the information that links to that search term. And so what that means is when you're thinking about the website, don't just put a really nice architecture up front on the home page, because a lot of people aren't even going to see the home page. You know, they're going to go down to the second level, the third level, or the fourth level of information on that website. They're going to go in the side door or the back door, not just the front door. Second point is, after you devise this really new and improved FEC.gov website, don't think that your job is over. You know, you can have the best new gadget in the country. If people don't know about it, they don't make use of it, you don't get the credit for having done it. And so we're recommending to all federal agencies that they really think about public service announcements promoting their website. The average citizen is not aware of all of the great information that is available on the web for a variety of agencies, not just the Federal Election Commission, but a bunch of other sites. And so we suggest that the promotional aspect should not be overlooked in the sense that you need to really kind of get the word out so that people understand the high-quality information that you have available. The last point that I will make is don't overestimate the readability of the American public. There have been detailed studies on this issue that have found that half of Americans read at the eighth grade or less. In our e-government studies, we look at the readability levels of various government agencies. We did that with the FEC site. It tested at the college graduate level in terms of readability, which is probably because of all the legal documents on your website. But just be aware that the need to communicate clearly with the general public requires shorter sentences and fewer syllables in the language. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. That was great. Now, you think if we do that, we can be number one?
You betcha. Okay. That's your goal.
Okay. Don't change your criteria on us. Any comments from any of the commissioners? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it is more of a comment than a question. I want to thank the panel for some very good, concrete suggestions. And you know, it's good to hear from other people because it just kind of turns your head around in terms of how you think about things. That statistic that only 4% of visitors enter government websites through the front page. I should know that because that's the way I find information on the Internet, except that's never the way I find information on the FEC's website, where I always go in from the front page. So it's good to hear that from you because that's not the way I use it. And it's also good to hear from you because if I can't find something, I just ask somebody to find it for me, which probably doesn't work for most members of the public. I just wanted to make two comments. One is a couple of folks have mentioned RSS feeds. We actually do have some of that, not a lot of it. There are some things that are available through RSS feeds. You can't do the candidate specific. That's a good suggestion. We do have... again, it's more focused for the regulated community. Tips for treasurers, sort of pushing out of interesting information that people who are in the business might be interested in knowing about, information about our commission meetings and obviously our press releases. The public hearing audio files are available as an RSS feed. So we have about 7 different categories of things that are available right now. Obviously, that's just a little thing, but I did want to let people know that, in fact, we do know what RSS feeds are and have begun to use that technology. And then I just wanted to thank in particular Michael Malbin for his longstanding interest and for his efforts and for working with us. I was not actually here in October of 2002 when you issued the report, but I was here for some of the follow-up meetings, and I'm sure you recall, you know, sitting in the conference room across the hall with me and a number of other folks, and it was very helpful then, and I appreciate your ongoing efforts and interest in working with us.
Well, that's for sure. Any other comments? I was going to ask about the question of the various standards, and would we have one standard format? Is that what you advocate, as I understand the...
Speaking of that. What I'm advocating for is for you to create a standard format for data intake and a standard format for data output. So right now you have a standard format. It's a custom format. You've heard people say CSV here. It's kind of like CSV. It's not particularly. It doesn't particularly even adhere to that. But you're actually publishing .fec files. They're the sort of the raw electronic campaign contribution information that's coming into the FEC before being vetted by FEC staff in the format that the developers submit them to you in, which has resulted in, you know, about a little more than a dozen different formats. I think 5 major versions and several minor versions. Being published by you. So what we think you should do is, one, be more stringent on the rules and say, if you're not publishing campaign contribution to us in today's format and it doesn't adhere to the format that you sent it to us, then you're not in compliance. And two, to create a format that is sort of that is standardized, in other words, that uses industry standards, not standardized in terms of the FEC has made the standard, but uses industry standards like XML, that is that you can then extend as legislation and other regulations require changes in the reporting format. But so that that base model, imagine, for instance, if Microsoft made it so that every new version of Microsoft Word could not read last year's version of Microsoft Word. And so on your computer,
Wouldn't that be called Vista?
sort of. You would have to
have.
Started
using Vista, I would agree with that.
You would have to have every version of Microsoft Word on your computer to read what people email you, because you wouldn't know what format they had. And so you would have to have every standard, every version of Microsoft Word installed so you could do that. And that's sort of what the FEC is doing right now, is it's saying you've got to have or write a particular, you know, a custom piece of code in order to parse each particular format, and we want you to stop that.
How do we begin to do that?
Well, step one is hire a new media director. I'm on message on that. But the second thing is, I think your IT department can start developing stuff. Code to translate all the old stuff into a standard format, I think fairly easily, depending on what data is there. And then, but most importantly, mandate that as information comes into the FEC, that it is not in compliance if it is not using the current day format.
So they would file a report and it would get kicked back and say, this is the format, try again?
That's correct.
And now, what would be them? The implications would not be maybe well met by the regulated community or the people who file without some work with them, or how to do that.
I think that's true. I think you would have to. I think that, you know, that's why I said in my testimony, you give yourself a matter of two election cycles to work through that process. The reason you know, sort of like the DTV switchover, except less of a, I think far less expensive and far less of a hassle, because you've got I think there are probably less campaign software vendors than there are people who have televisions, but
they're vocal,
but they're a vocal community. You will have to work with them over the next 4 years to do it, but that will, I think, do two things. One is it will make it easier for other vendors to participate in this process. It will lower the barrier to entry so that lots of companies can actually handle sending filings to the FEC. And two, it will make it so that watchdog organizations like the Sunlight Foundation can actually get to that data more efficiently and effectively. And volunteers, you know, part of the reason I came to the Sunlight Foundation is I wanted to do some information, just a neat little mashup with FEC data, and couldn't do it and started ranting about it. And then Ellen, my boss, snatched me up. And that's how I got there. So.
Well, we're glad you got worked up over it. Professor?
I just want to supplement that point by giving you another reason for thinking about the timetable, and this is in my written comment. A pretty fair amount of your material is in COBOL.
Right, I was going to ask you. You say the FEC eventually will have to move away from this antiquated programming language.
Yeah, and the people who know how to do COBOL are retiring. You really need to get them while they're around and start this process. It's not a top priority urgency this election process, but you do want your material to be backwards compatible. So you can hire people as consultants to do this, but you know, eventually we all face the mortality tables, and this stuff was programmed in 1975 is when you began it. It's 40 some odd years ago.
Yesterday was COBOL's 50th anniversary.
Okay, but the FEC started its stuff then, and you know, you need just do the math. It's you need to get into a more compatible mode.
From a layman's point of view, what programming language is one to move to?
I don't have an opinion on that. Okay. But by the way, I do think that this is fun. This is a programming issue, not a new media issue. So go ahead.
I would go with Python or Ruby. But it's a personal preference. I mean, these are, you know, depending on the team that you want to build inside, a lot of federal agencies use Java. And a lot of them use Microsoft .NET platform, although we're a little skittish about that at Sunlight. At the Sunlight Foundation, what we're doing, one interesting thing that we're doing is we're taking, we recently paid, and this should speak to the importance of your wholesale business. We recently paid Open Secrets over $1 million to release their data to the public so that people could get access to it. We gave them a $1 million grant to release all of their data to the public. Now they take FEC data, clean it up, and release it. And then we've also done the same thing with the National Institute of Money and State Politics, which does what Open Secrets does for all 50 states. And it's our intention to take all of that information and put it into one database so that you can, you know, basically type into a computer Exxon and see how much money Exxon is giving to in campaign contributions, period, on no matter what level. So we're starting to standardize the names, and I do want to speak to the last panel to a second. Starting to standardize the names and of entities inside these things, whether they be corporations or people, and that isn't something that the FEC wants to wander down. That's a really hard problem to solve. It's computationally extremely significant, and it's not something that we're going to get exactly right either. But we're going to do our best, and we'll be happy to share with you the results. And hopefully the whole community can take part in that. But in dealing with your data, and the way that we manage our team of about, we have about 15 developers, 13 developers at the Sunlight Foundation. They program in Python, Ruby, and Java. Those are their big three languages.
What about the ones, the other government agencies like ours are bigger, who are going to be around forever and that language won't change and we know that we don't have to?
Well, nothing's around forever, right?
Yeah, well, I grant you that. But
I think other government agencies are using a lot of Java. Although they're getting turned on to, I think, some of these newer, more dynamic languages like Python and Ruby. None of them are going anywhere, so to speak. Neither is COBOL. COBOL is, as I mentioned, I think older than this agency. There are around 7.2 billion lines of COBOL code in the federal government, which is far more than U.S. code. It's not going to go anywhere, although it's not a particularly great language. And, you know, I think it's correct to say that in 10 years you're not going to have, 10 to 20 years, there's not going to be a lot of COBOL programmers out there. But there may not be a lot of Java programmers out there either.
Professor?
But with the other programmers, they export quite easily. And the other programs. And COBOL, there were quirks. So you have less of a danger once you switch. But the process to go the route, I didn't have anything to say about a particular program. But I would say that you have other people in the government who are doing this now, who are going through the... So in WhiteHouse.gov and the OMB, even though you're not legally in the executive branch, you just should meet with these people and have economies of scale and share the information.
Is there a government agency that helps with websites? I got the impression when we were working this up that there is one that kind of gives guidance to government agencies. Should we go?
GSA does.
Just a GSA, okay. I thought there was some kind of an organization or something. No?
I also think there's the technology, I forgot her name, the technology officer in the Office of Science. And
Beth Novick.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's Beth Novick and that team at OSTP. They're particularly good at this stuff.
Great. Let's see. Any other questions by anybody else at this point? Push them again?
No.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
I've got a question, and maybe...
this would be best directed, at least at the outset, to Mr. Johnson. I don't know if you were here for the first panel when there was a lot of discussion about the search capacities in the website, especially with respect to the EQS, where the basically the Enforcement Matters database. And I don't know if you had a chance to look at that in particular, or if you've looked at the search engines on the site in general. Just wanted to get your thoughts about, if you have taken a look at those, what could we do to improve those so that those could be, I think, at least the EQS search engine was described to be in crisis. And so are there, again, if you've had a chance to look at that and have any ideas, and the others, if they've had a chance to look at that as well, what we might be able to do in order to improve that system to make it much more easily accessible by those who want to search through those databases.
So I'll be honest in saying that I actually disagree with my cohorts to a certain extent that 50% of the FEC's job should be enforcement and regulation. I actually think that it should be most of the FEC's effort should be on disclosure. That's what's listed first, I think, in your charter and legislation. But I do know a bit about search. Just off the record, I haven't looked at enforcement, the EQS search technique. There's part of. I'm just sort of gonna wing it here to a certain extent and provide general advice. When the FEC provides a lot of documents in file formats that aren't particularly great for the web. So, for instance, even the call for participation for this hearing was in a scanned 46-page PDF file, and it could have just been sort of, you could have just edited. It could have been a web page rather than something that you have to sort of download and open up with something other than a web browser, and that creates a barrier to entry for people. Some people don't have the Adobe Reader and that kind of thing. And when you,
in layman's terms, what are you saying?
What I'm saying is, sometimes that can affect searches as well, and you wanna be able to make it so that not only your search engine works on your stuff, but also say Google can index your search pages, because quite honestly, people may in fact use and prefer to use Google rather than the FEC's search or Yahoo. I don't want to advertise for a particular vendor here, but they are responsible for, I think, 80% of search traffic now. You want to make it so that people can find it through there as well. That's my only real advice, because again, I haven't looked in particular at that. Piece of what you were asking for. I was focused mainly on disclosure. I do want to say something though about this concept of coming in through the front door and how that's the example was used of people type into Google Nancy Pelosi campaign finance information. If you go and type in Nancy Pelosi, I did it while they were testifying. If you type in Nancy Pelosi campaign finance information, right now the first thing that comes up is not FEC.gov, it is opensecrets.org. And if you do that, I would bet, I did it for Chuck Schumer too, and I did it for Saxby Chambliss. They all come up with opensecrets.org first. OpenSecrets gets around 10 times the amount of traffic that FEC.gov gets, in part because of this. And this should speak to why the wholesale business is so important, because as that data gets pushed out, if they are getting that information, and that's why it should be the number one priority, as that data gets pushed out to these other organizations and people are finding the information that way, those, I think, you have to look at as your customers too, in as much as the manufacturers of Timex watches view the people who pick up the Timex watch at Kmart as their customers as well. And you are in fact suppliers of raw materials that these people use. And an excellent strategy should be, or would be, for you to really focus on your wholesale efforts of data, and then when you're ready to do the retail stuff after that stuff is sorted out, make your retail operation work and pull from the same wholesale supplier as everyone else, so to speak, to extend that metaphor.
If I could come back to the search question, Mr. Peterson, I would agree with the characterization that for all government agencies, not just the FEC, the search function is in crisis. They're terrible. I mean, go to any government agency, do a search, and you just get kind of a ream of unrelated and unnuanced types of searches. If you look at private sites, commercial sites, you will see the difference. Like at a good private company site that has a good search engine, you generally have an advanced feature that allows you to add nuances to the search. Like for the FEC, you might want both candidate and time period as searchable elements within that search engine. In terms of the way the search gets produced, a lot of high-quality search engines now will produce results and then give you control over chronology versus relevance as the ranking tool. Maybe you want the most recent reference to Nancy Pelosi, or maybe you want a term that is most relevant appearing at the top of that search. So I think given consumer behavior that really seeks information through search engines, it should really be a high priority for the FEC to upgrade that, because I think that is very important. And then to reinforce one thing Clay was mentioning, most search engines do not operate very effectively with PDF files. Just the way that PDF files are configured, they're generally not very searchable because they're an aggregate. And so when you're developing your website, just be careful that you present information that is accessible to the search engines.
To add to that that point, or the question generated out of this morning's panel, as I understood the recommendation, it was to put everything from all the MURs from the year 1974 up in web searchable form.
That's correct.
I would wonder whether that's even for the attorneys involved as higher priority as they expressed it. I think it's probably important to put the FEC's disposition memorandum, or whatever that's called, up and deal with that as opposed to all of the underlying material. We're talking about a lot of material here that you're going to need to make digital form. And do you really need to make the entire file digital and then make the search engine search through the entire file? And then I do think you're going to end up with what people talked about, a rather random-looking assortment of 10,000 or 10 million hits. If given the state of the microfilm and the state of all of these documents, you may just want, I would suggest you start with the one-page summary of each issue, or whatever they are, or the FEC decision, and not all of the background material. The background material, if you are led to the particular case as being relevant to your point, then I believe it's okay to open up a PDF. I don't think it's such a, to have that is the print document. That's not what needs to be searched. Second, consider when you are going through this process, having something more than a full-text consumer-generated word search. Virtually all of these things relate to specific provisions in the Code of Federal Regulations or a piece in the statute. So if as part of your tag in the underlying what's called the metadata, and if it's there, then the person who is doing the looking, often an attorney, will know that I need to be looking on such and such a subject, and the searches can be made much more compact. And again, if you do it with what Daryl just said, you give people these radio buttons, these windows, to narrow the search. What are you looking for? Matters under review. When you go to that, it says, oh, is there a particular section of the law or regulation you want to look at? It'll make the whole search process much more user-friendly.
Ms. Vice Chairman.
I certainly appreciate all these comments. How complicated of a project would it be for the government to transition from, I guess what we have now is a little bit clunky in terms of our search capacities, to something that has much more of a nuanced and sophisticated method for obtaining the results that you're looking for? I mean, is this a resource-intensive, time-intensive process to make that transition? Is it something that can be done, you know, relatively quickly? Or, I mean, what are we looking at in order to try to upgrade our search capabilities?
Well, I know the chief technology officer for the federal government is looking at the possibility of some government-wide contracts on generic things that cut across individual agencies. So on search in particular, since this is something in crisis across all agencies and is a generic function, it seems to me that's a perfect thing for a government-wide contract so that you can get the economy of scale, so you can save money, you can be efficient. And then also it helps the user because then they have a consistent search experience across all agencies.
Search is a really hard problem to solve. Before I was at Blue State, I was a programmer at a company called Ask Jeeves, which is the butler that some of you may remember from a long time ago. And search was our business there, and it was hard. There are ways for you to do this that are cheap that maybe a federal agency shouldn't do. But you could, which is, you know, sort of basically give the problem to Google. Make all of your documents Google indexable and searchable. Convert them into, you know, HTML files from PDF files, and then make sure, and you can do this very cheaply, make sure that Google can index those documents from the Google search engine itself, and then Google actually allows you to run a custom search of just a particular piece of the web, which you could say is your website, where people could search. Although that might not solve the problem, as there you may need to, you know, you wouldn't be able to do things like search particular date ranges, but you could probably have better contextual search that way, and you know that's free. That doesn't cost any money. It would cost you money to do the document conversion, but even then, you know, the New York Times recently converted, around 20 years of their daily newspaper into searchable format. They used a technology called Hadoop. And it costs them around $240 and 12 days of time. This technology stuff, it's really easy to get, I don't know how to say this any kinder or gentler of a way, but it's really easy to get scammed. And the more advanced we get, it's really important to realize that the more advanced we get at this stuff, actually the cheaper all this stuff becomes. It doesn't become more expensive, it gets cheaper. And I really wish that, you know, and this is, you know, I think for all government agencies, I really wish that government agencies would sort of get that, as I think government-wide people are thinking about how to use you know, the web and new technologies to further their missions. I think there are a lot of government contractors out there going, this is an exciting way for us to double our prices, and you know, I just want to put it out there that you should be aware of that and look for, there are oftentimes a much cheaper solution for problems that can save the taxpayers millions of dollars.
Commissioner Merrill had a question.
Thank you. The panel just preceding this one, one of the comments dealt with information privacy and the potential for identity theft. And obviously, we have an obligation to disclose. And the current disclosure regime includes addresses which can be useful to general solicitors or could be, you know, subject to people to potential identity theft. And obviously, that are all bad outcomes that we have to balance against this overwhelming need and requirement for disclosure. So I wondered, Mr. West, in your review of other agencies, we have unique data, I think, compared to other agencies, but obviously there is other publicly available information, and you looked at state governments as well, where obviously there's a lot of property information, which includes all of this as well. Are there ways that other government agencies have figured out how to try to protect people while still disclosing the information they're required to?
I mean, the nice thing about the FEC data is you do have name and address, but there's no or little other personal information beyond that. So I would be less worried about identity theft there. I mean, because what thieves want is really not your address, but other information that will allow them to access much more valuable material. So in general, even though it's an issue, and I know the FEC has rules on, you know, using that information, and people just can't take the information, so that becomes an enforcement issue, I would not see this as a high priority for the commission as a problem to worry about.
If publishing a name and address was a privacy risk in terms of identity theft, then, you know, we'd probably all be out in the streets burning our phone books, as they all have our names and addresses in them. But it is more of a. I think what the last panel was speaking to an extent was how it could discourage. It could either discourage campaign contributions, or participation, and you know, transparency and privacy. I know that Sunlight will be doing its job right when privacy advocates start complaining about what we do. So far, we actually, you know, work on the same team with them to a certain extent to make sure that we're doing our jobs right.
But there certainly is. I mean, I get emails from people asking why their name is suddenly on a government website, and it's very different than a phone book. I mean, right? I mean, the internet has changed the world. I don't have a phone book, for example. So it really has changed the access level. You know, and I don't have to go to Topeka, Kansas to get their phone book to get people's information. And maybe it is an education process, but there are a number of people who have. I have no idea who they are. It's just send in emails and say, I can't believe you are, you know, invading my privacy in this way. And so maybe it's a fear that's not well-founded, given that identity thieves are looking for much more detailed, you know, social security numbers and birth dates and lots of other information. But there is, I think, and perhaps it is an education opportunity that we need to make better use of. But there are people who are surprised and I think concerned, and this may either result in them not wanting to give again, or, you know, in certain instances, you know, people are concerned about people knowing where they live and that sort of thing. So I think it's out there, but I was just curious if other government agencies have ways of doing this, and maybe it is an education thing that we just need to let people know this is what's going to happen when you make a contribution. It's going to be, you know, I think campaigns tell people that it's going to be filed. Maybe they don't realize the next step is it goes up on the web.
You don't need to look at other government agencies. The fact is, your electronic files have two different practices. You have one set of files that does with the address and the other that doesn't. The other has just the zip code. And so the question is, for what public disclosure need do you, what if you were to leave out the street address field, would there be any important public disclosure function that would not be served? Now, that's a policy and not quite a web question. If you want me to speak to the policy issue, I'd say I'm not sure that, I mean, I don't see what you'd lose if you didn't have the street address. Maybe you would. There's a slightly more difficult to match the names and decide if Jim Jones is the same as James Jones, but not a lot. There are a large number of policy areas in this arena, as we all know from having watched California, which has a low disclosure threshold, and there was intimidation against donors in a recent ballot initiative, There's also policy arguments for driving the disclosure threshold down lower, because there are fraud questions that people have raised. So this is a not easy policy question, but in terms of what you put on the web, doesn't necessarily have to include everything that a candidate has to file with you.
Just one last follow-up. Mr. Johnson, your organization uses our data and does things with it. Would you have a perspective on whether the data you pull should be as complete as it can be, or whether things like if there were a policy decision to delete a street address, that would be a problem.
It would be a huge problem for us. The reason why is because of the name standardization issue. You know, if you wanted to make our job easier and solve the problem, although this, you know, this would be difficult, I think, for even the FEC to do, is instead of publishing names and addresses of everyone, make it so that before someone gives some form of campaign contribution, they have to register and get some form of ID number from the FEC. And that way we can sort of uniquely identify every person that's giving contributions. Really, it doesn't matter what their location is. It matters, you know, who or what their street address is. It matters that to us is that they are that person, right? So we can tell that, you know, the campaign contributor X has given, who's the CEO of Corporation Y, has given money to candidate Z, which resulted in, you know, legislation being passed or you know, some other thing. And what we need to know is that that person is in fact that person, and verify their identity. That's what we're after. With our current stuff, the way that it works to an extent is we look at data from all 50 states, we look at data the FEC is putting out, and we make some judgments, and we say, okay, well, this person's occupation and employer is the same here and here, and their zip codes are the same, and their names are roughly similar. It's a safe assumption that they are the same person. If everybody had, you know, if everybody had some form of public security Social Security number, then obviously our job would get a lot easier. But I'd imagine that that time that I was referring to earlier, where the privacy advocates and the transparency organizations start to be at odds with each other, happens then.
Yeah, we go through the same iteration, and I suspect you have a little bit better percentage identification than we do, but we use the exact fields that you mentioned, which is to say employer and zip code, not necessarily the street address. And the street address is the one that really bothers people.
Right, that's true. There are a few Clay Johnsons in Washington, D.C., but only one that works for the Sunlight Foundation.
The four digits after the usual zip code, there was a recommendation that we include that. And the reason being, what other than just more refinement when it comes to identifying someone?
Yep. Oh, I mean, the other side of that, though, is most people don't know what their
what
zip was for.
Yeah. Right. Commissioner Bailey, I'm sorry if I interrupted. Did you have any more questions? Our time is up. But I want to thank you all very much for being here. It's been great. We had two terrific panels this morning. Within the first part of next week, you'll be able to see the transcript of the entire hearing online. And if you have any follow-up questions comments, please give them to us. We're going to keep the comment period open because we'll have a closeout session a little later on. But thanks again for everything.
Thank you.
And hope to see us in the top 10 shortly. During the meeting.